So this is, I guess, were you able to update the spreadsheets at all?
Yeah, if you look on the numbers for hard drive, for running on the hard drive, are there for the 50% runs and the runs at the double that memory, which was the entire work.
What is the high level conclusion?
So when we run at full memory, so there's no non-blocking writes, it runs at the same time.
At the same time.
Yeah, at the same time across each.
Mm-hmm.
And when we run at 50%, there's some cases where we do better, but for the most part, we're either really close or way worse.
Way worse.
Yeah.
And this is with the simple yield optimization.
Yeah.
Like these are all the.
Yeah. The ones on the left hand side are all the hard drive ones. The ones that I had numbers for SSD are on this side.
Okay.
Except for these two first columns.
The first two columns are hard
drive. Are the ones from the older data.
Older. Yeah. That's
how about SSD versus disk?
We're still slower for the most part. SSD, we get relatively close for most of the numbers, or in some cases we're a little bit faster, but it's about the same.
Okay.
I see. So this is the vanilla performance.
Yeah.
And the non-blocking writes too is...
Is that these two are both SSD.
Or the yield.
No.
It's a little bigger. It's too big.
Yeah, so this last column is normal non-blocking rates without the optimization on SSD, and then these are the ones with the two optimizations. I should probably just get rid of those first two columns.
So it seems like the optimizations help. Is it always true? The optimizations help?
I think so. I think maybe there was one case where they didn't. That's the 2x memory run, so all of the numbers are pretty much around the same.
Oh, that's the same, the memory equal to working set?
Yeah.
Okay, this is also memory equal to working set?
Yeah, in this case, I think it did worse.
That's weird.
Yeah. But it's off by quite a bit, so I don't know if it's just, because I had to rerun it multiple times, because Batic is one of the ones that tends to not, like when I run the five experiments back-to-back, usually like two fail, something like that.
Hmm.
And I also have to disable the file system non-blocking rights, because if not, it just does not run.
This is kind of weird.
Yeah.
Even at full memory, you have a significant degradation.
Actually, this one's at half memory.
This is half memory?
Yeah, that one's at half memory. The next sheet over is the one at full memory. And that one, the numbers are consistent.
Okay, that's interesting. So I guess non-blocking rights is not being exercised in this case. On to the next one.
In this one, this is one where we actually did better. Not by very much, or if you look at, I guess, the small margin, it's about the same.
But actually in this is better, much better.
Yeah, this is this track?
Mm-hmm. You see vanilla is 34 seconds, while non-blocking rights,
I think all of this is SSD.
These are all SSD. These two are hard disk.
Okay.
Yeah. So these should be compared with these.
Okay.
Yeah. I was gonna fix them because I just moved all of these out of the way so I could put in the hard disk.
Did you try disk with yield?
Yeah. These are all. This is all disk. That's vanilla disk, non-blocking write disk, and
okay.
The two yield
okay.
ones.
Okay. Got it.
Interestingly, there's not a whole lot of difference between SSD and disk.
Yeah, I think it's because Jython is more, I guess, CPU bound than anything else.
At least that half memory to CPU bound.
Yeah.
And that full memory, again, it would be the same thing.
Yeah, I guess for some reason, either Jython just doesn't exercise non-blocking rights is what it looks like. Yeah, and this one is one where we actually did close and actually a little bit better with TMD, with the scheduling improvements.
So scheduling means every fault, whether major or minor, is going to yield?
Yeah.
And
on the first one, yeah.
Prefetch means that if it's a minor fault, you don't yield.
Yep.
Okay.
So
we don't see any, I mean, the only consistent pattern that I see here, and you can correct me, it seems like the yield optimization actually helps. Well, we don't have those numbers here, for instance.
Yeah, I need to put those numbers.
Without the optimization. Mm-hmm. But you
have I have all those numbers. It's just that when I moved, I think one of the sheets, it might have been the PMD one,
mm-hmm.
when I was moving numbers around, I accidentally removed some that I shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd have to go back and fix that.
Yeah, so it seems like the optimization has, in this case, this seems really different. I mean, this is...
Oh, yeah, because these two are still hard drives.
Oh, these two are still hard drives. Okay.
Yeah.
Right, so I think you can maybe reorganize the spreadsheet.
Yeah, because I was just moving stuff out of the
like
way.
That. So, okay, so maybe you can do that over the next week so that the spreadsheets are easier to read. And if you have, like, a title... create a title bar across all the columns and say, okay, this is for this
hard drive,
SSD. And if you put it in the same place and in all the sheets, then it'll be much easier to read.
Yeah, and these are just 100% memory room, so we're not incurring too much of an extra overhead.
Yeah, so I wonder what's going on. I mean, it seems there are two consistent observations. One is that the scheduling optimizations improve the non-blocking write performance. The other is that even with those optimizations, it seems like at 100%, at 50% memory, we are not able to exceed the performance of vanilla.
Yeah.
In some cases, we are able to match the performance of vanilla. In other cases, we...
Well, we do a little bit better, I think, in Jython.
Mm.
No, not Jython. Might have been PMD.
PMD.
And one of them we do better. Yeah, in PMD, we do a little bit better than vanilla. Not by too much, but...
Right.
But to me, it seems that since it's not really a smart solution, we're just sort of going, well, if it's the first one, we'll wait and see if maybe the I/O completes.
Mm-hmm.
But that,
what you're saying is that the thing's gonna get better once you get the scheduler.
Yeah, because here it's just sort of like, well, we'll wait once, once that page, and then. You know, if we happen to get rescheduled again, and the page still isn't done, we're just going to do a whole bunch of non-blocking writes, and at that point you're sort of eating up CPU. And if another I/O completes and that process can run, that one's stuck waiting for
mm-hmm.
the non-blocking write process.
At least I guess the good thing we can take out of this is that we know now that the scheduling is a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And once we solve the CPU scheduler, I think it's going to get better because of what you're saying. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, in the worst case, it'll perform at the vanilla speed.
Yeah, that's a hypothesis.
Okay, so we'll come to that next. But before we go there, I'm just wondering, is there any... thing that we're missing, for instance, the way we are doing experiments. I just want to make sure that we're not introducing some effects that compromise our numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's walk through that process. So you restart the machine, right? Boot into the new kernel. You run the experiment, right? That's one run.
Run them in batches of five, which are the ones that I use here.
So you run them back to back?
Yeah, I'll run one, I'll drop, we drop the caches, we clear everything up, and then we go ahead and run it again, and I repeat that five times.
Okay, so but it's back to back without any, let's say, you know, without any gap, right,
yeah.
Without any sleep. The reason I ask
so
is...
there's a sleep for, I think, a second or two somewhere in the script.
Right.
But...
Right, the reason I ask is, for instance, there might be straggler IOs that affect the subsequent run.
Okay.
Right. Does that make sense? So we're issuing all these IOs, right, for non-blocking writes.
Mm-hmm.
and we don't wait until they complete.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that in the case of there are two cases. There is the anonymous case. Once the process finished, all IOs and everything that was part of that, of the virtual memory of that process is disabled. It's just for you.
But you've already sent it to the device. But can you cancel these IOs after you send it to the device?
It won't be canceled. But I think we have 1 second in the middle.
Yeah.
It's most likely going to be done by then.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if that is that could introduce, let's say, more variability.
Sure.
That we see a lot of variability,
yeah.
Here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, sure. The other thing is that when we drop the caches, you cannot leave. I mean, once the caches are dropped, there's actually no IOs for the cache. All the IOs need to be done.
So you're saying the drop cache will block until all the pending IOs are completed?
Yes, because the thing is that in order to drop the caches, the thing is that when you drop caches, the only parts that are actually dropped are the ones that are clean, right? So before that, you need to do a sync to clean everything.
But so anonymous memory is
anonymous
not
memory is different, I agree, yeah.
And these are all anonymous, right?
Yes, true.
Your potentials will sync, right? Or do you not sync?
Have to sync explicitly.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, in the case of anonymous.
Oh, I think 1 second should be long for all.
I think that too. But I do.
Non-dispatch, because usually you can only dispatch requests one at a time. So if the process finishes and it's still got a bunch of requests. Those requests are canceled, and at most there's only one other request, and the longest I can take is maybe like 10 milliseconds or something.
So the requests get canceled if the process exits?
Yeah, so if you have a list of pending IOs for a process, which is why sometimes if you exit a process without calling like fclose and sync, your contents still get written back, because all those things that were modified were just thrown away when the process ends.
But the IOs which are already out will still be the complete.
The ones that have already been sent to the device will finish.
What happens with the ones in the scheduler?
The ones in the scheduler will get tossed out.
So
that seems a little odd.
How they can complete it if you're already getting rid of all the pages of the process?
You still have the page lock.
Pages are locked, I guess.
So the DMA region is still set up, and the DMA region is still going to get written to. But once you release the lock on the page has no more reference counts. And so that page is just considered junk at that point.
I see. So okay, we have two separate theories. One theory here is that dropping cache might actually block until all the IOs complete.
That's for file system.
That's not for anonymous.
It is true for file systems?
It's true for file systems. For anonymous, I don't think so. Well, actually, I don't think so.
And for anonymous, you're saying that the 1 second interval
should
that we have between experiments is sufficient to finish all IOs and apply all patches, etc.
That would be, but applying patches would take very long. And IOs should be, like, 1 second is quite a bit of IOs.
Yeah, 1 second, I mean, in a disk drive would be, I would say, in the worst case, 25 milliseconds per IO. That's about 400 IOs.
Yeah,
no,
that's
40 IOs, sorry.
Yeah.
40 IOs. 40 IOs. I don't know if you've seen queues build up more than 40. In some cases, you've seen queues build up to much more than 40,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, so I'm just saying that
I can do a couple of test runs where I just run one and then wait just like an entire minute and then run another one again.
Right. I think there are some simple experiments that we can do, right?
Just to sort of tie up
all the loose ends,
mm-hmm.
so that we know that whatever experiments we are doing are as robust as we can make it.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think even a simple wait of 1 minute is it's good. Right? Yeah. I mean, in that case, you can do 2400.
Yeah.
Higher. So. No, actually 240.
In 1 minute? Well, I think we said 40 times 60.
Oh,
2400.
Okay.
2400. Well, the 25 milliseconds is usually when you have to spin the disk back up and then wait for the reset.
Yeah, 25 milliseconds.
25 milliseconds. Yeah, it's a really worst case.
Yeah.
Disk latency. No, no, no.
Spin the disk back up.
Not disk backup. If you want to wait for the disk to spin back up, you have to wait several seconds.
Several seconds. Yeah.
Like 7 to 8 seconds.
Yeah.
This is in the worst case when you're like have
the
full speed and a full rotation, then it would be something like a 25 milliseconds. Yeah, spin up is way longer.
Yeah.
So I think we should do that because I somehow feel that there is still too much variability in here.
Yeah.
And that could be because of these sorts of effects that we think we are able to get rid of, but they don't go away completely.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for us to do that.
Okay.
Because even if we make the scheduling optimization, we might still have this.
Yeah.
Right. So just, okay, so these are two separate things that we should do.
By the way, this issue would happen in vanilla? You won't, right?
It won't. Yeah, vanilla
there's
always
no
blocks.
Extra
There are no straggler IOs at all in vanilla.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's one.
Although I think in vanilla, there's still the same amount.
There's
of
still
like,
variability.
There's still quite
yeah.
a bit of variability.
That's true. And it's still a lot of
68 to 145
whole system.
So that's the other thing. Is it possible that somehow the drop caches is not implemented correctly, or whatever it is that we are doing?
Unless it's really random, I don't know.
Well, but I mean, in this case, it's just an error. So even
that,
even
the cache
is that wrong won't have much effect.
Okay, the next thing then is maybe the device state is not the same across these runs. Right.
Probably
so in this
true.
Case, what is this? This is a hard disk drive. I guess it shouldn't matter all that much.
Well, one thing we can do is before running the experiments, we read the sectors here or something like that.
I don't mean it in that way. Because there's just,
what
a lot of variability. There's like
200%.
Yeah. So I think understanding the variability itself would be a very interesting problem.
Is it possible to run this by just having that process run without booting all the system?
Yeah,
and
we can
for
put
that
it
process?
In a tab.
I tried that.
And still?
I think that, if I remember correctly, the...
It helped, but not
very
much.
It helped, but not much, yeah. But we can try that again.
I think some of your numbers might be from when we did the init tabs.
Mm-hmm. Right, because I think if we cannot convince ourselves that we've taken care of every possible source of external source of variability that can be controlled, then we don't have sufficient confidence in these numbers,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's really what I want us to work on, is to address all sources that we can actually control. Of course, the program can, or the OS can introduce effects because of the way it's built, or it just the inter-thread scheduling schedules, because it can vary so much, also affects how IOs get done, and that affects times. And all of that is possible. But I'm saying in terms of experimental setup, we should try to do the best we can to control, other effects.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe someone can just look at how to reduce the variability. I know we went there before, but I want us to go there again a little bit, revisit that question to see, okay, what sort of experimental procedure reduces that variability? Does sleeping for 1 second versus 10 seconds make a difference between runs? Does rebooting the system between runs reduce the variability? Because although you drop caches, there's still some perhaps something in DRAM that is different than what it was before the experiment started the previous time, right? So those are the kinds of things. So drop caches, does it mean free up the same amount of memory and restore the state of free memory to what it was before the experiment, or no? Right? Do all drop caches lead to the same resultant memory footprint of the rest of the system? Right? And I don't know. I think it would be good to understand all this, because I think our results are very closely tied to how memory is utilized, right? Because that will govern the number of faults, that will basically affect how well our optimization does versus not.
Right.
So I want us to understand that a little bit better.
The group members need to, that thing that we were using is a VM to avoid the randomization of the virtual address space. That might help. I don't know.
I don't think address space randomization in this specific instance.
You mean ASLR?
Yeah.
It's just an offset.
It's just logic address.
Yeah, it's just a logical address. It doesn't
change.
Yeah, it doesn't change the physical layout.
Yeah. The amount of memory that is utilized by the rest of the system will affect how many faults you have,
mm-hmm.
besides just, you know, how the threads get interleaved on the single core. Even that will affect how many faults you have. But the external sources, we should try to control. What are the other things that we can do? You've tried several things, right? Running this in level 3 or whatever init level.
Yeah.
That does not boot up the rest of the
system. I guess what I did was to run this our benchmark right before everything has started.
Yeah, before any services or daemons or any of that.
Can you change init for the process?
Yeah, it was a script, I think.
Yeah, actually what happened is not exactly that, but what happened is that init, at least in Gen 2, there is one configuration file where you tell init what to run in what order.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was to say, okay, run this first, and then boot the system up.
Mm-hmm. We're thinking on this line and
graph. But the thing is that there are some tricky things there, because you need to mount the file system, read-write, and a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
We also need network, so we need to bring network up.
Why network?
Because we have a logging system to log all things that are happening inside the kernel.
So we have the ability to capture the number of page faults, right?
Yeah.
Can we focus on vanilla and do 5 runs of vanilla and just look at the number of page faults that happen in our current experimental methodology? Do you see that does that get reported? Do you get to see those numbers while you're doing these experiments?
I think we have those numbers in one of the output files. Yeah.
Okay, so I think it would be good for us to understand whether, even without non-blocking writes, there's still a lot of variability. How can we reduce that variability? I don't know. I think that's a good question.
Are you disabling the other cores?
Yeah.
So we have SMP disabled, we have
preemption
kernel control. Preemption disabled.
But do you power off the cores?
They don't
power.
Turn on. When you turn on the computer, only one core turns on.
Mm.
And then if you turn off config SMP, it just doesn't do any of the code that turns on the other cores.
Yeah, I guess the best we can do is with the init tab and see how that goes again. In fact, I don't remember why we changed back to normal.
Because we didn't, it wasn't very much of a difference,
mm-hmm.
I think. Because we were still getting a lot of variability.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay.
And that was with vanilla, or?
This was
for both.
Yeah, we did both.
But you can revisit that. Mm-hmm. They have changed a lot of stuff, so probably something changed there.
Are you formatting the disk device every time?
Are you formatting it?
Pre-formatting.
We don't really change anything on disk, though.
Why? I mean,
I was thinking maybe the items get in different places in the device.
The only thing that gets created, I think, is the only file system modification that happens is the logs from when the kernel boots, and
I guess
sometimes
when
the benchmark crashes, it gives you an error log.
Right.
But that's all, I guess, extra stuff. I don't know how the
benchmarks don't create any file.
No, right. The benchmark actually has some scratch space where it does some stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. But I don't think that's making a big difference.
Yeah, that's why. It's mostly just new writes.
We should just first look at the number of faults.
Yes, actually that. If we see the number of faults are the same, but the numbers are different, then we can say safely that, because at the end it's the same amount of files, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is different then is how the device reacts.
Yeah. I think that's probably the first thing we should do, is to understand fault behavior. Okay, so now going to the other aspect, which is the scheduling optimization, how are we doing with that?
It sort of works. There's one function that has to do with the addition, I think, of sched groups. There's, sometimes it maintains a group CFSRQ, and what happens is I still haven't fixed that function, so when there's a non-blocking write process that's in that group and the other ones aren't, sometimes, or actually all the time, the CFS that it'll get for that group will be the normal one, but if it's requesting it for the non-blocking write process, it gets the wrong run queue.
I think
you
have to go a little slower for me.
So
I didn't understand what you
mean. So in the run queue, there's normally just one CFS RQ, which is just the standard sort of process list.
Okay, and
so
this is for a single core, there's only one, right?
Yeah,
only a single core.
So we added another one per core, which is the non-blocking write queue.
Right.
But there's a lot of inline, this just sort of inline functions in the CFS scheduler implementation that will give you the CFS run queue if you give it a task, if you give it the scheduling entity, if you give it the task group, or if you give it the run queue, different things like that. But since we added another CFS run queue to that, depending on whether the process or whatever is being requested is part of the non-blocking write queue, we need to give that CFS run queue instead of the regular one.
So basically change all these inline implementations to do a check and then return the correct run queue.
Can you do something like you add a pointer in the structure
and
then...
What I've done is... Some of them, so like the sched entity, I fixed that one. I found there was some there's some code that you can call that will set up the right CFS run queue inside the sched entity, so that one works fine. The one that doesn't work is the sched entity that is a group by itself. So there's no task associated with it.
Okay.
So my normal the thing that I normally do is when they give me a pointer to like if it's the task, all I have to do is check the reference count on the task. If it's a positive number, then I just get the run queue for that task, and then I choose the non-blocking write queue. And if it's zero, I just return the normal queue.
If you put the new queue inside the CFQ structure itself, would that make things easier?
What do you mean?
You know that right now, I remember the name of the structure, but there is a structure that has inside the CFS queue, right? That's the one that you repeated.
Yeah, there's the CFS RQ and the normal RQ, and then there's pointers back to it from the scheduling entity for the task. But there's certain scheduling entities that don't have a task associated with them, and those are the ones that are giving me issues.
Okay.
And those are part of the sched groups.
Okay.
So you're saying in terms of software design, that it seems like there's no simple way to deal with that design.
There's, I guess, in sort of a hackish way, if I can get a pointer to the task, then I can figure it out and do something like that, but I haven't found any way to do that.
What I was saying is that, because it seems like you're fixing, you need to fix, okay, there were two structures, eh?
Yeah.
There was one structure.
You can erase that if you want. Yeah. To look at.
There was one structure that has CFSQ or something.
Yeah, CFSRQ.
RQ. And what you did was to add a non-blocking write RQ.
Yeah.
Right? Which is exactly the same. I guess what we discussed was that, okay, the good thing about that is that now the non-blocking write request can use all the functions where the CFQ is used.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like you have to change many things to make this work.
Yeah.
So what I was saying is that what about if you, because this is a structure by itself.
Yeah.
How about if you move non-blocking write queue inside? Would that make things easier?
Inside of the CFSR queue?
Yeah.
Then that would have to be a point. Since they're both the same type, I would have to have a pointer to...
I guess you wouldn't, in that case, it wouldn't be the same type. You would have to change the type to whatever is inside this CFRQ, CFSRQ.
The thing is that the CFSRQ has a lot of statistics and numbers that it needs.
Right, but it needs to have a queue inside, right?
Yeah.
Right, so what I'm saying is that you duplicate that queue.
Mm-hmm.
Have a new non-blocking write queue
inside of the CFS.
And then you work with that. So in that way, what I see is that you don't have to change all the pointers because at the end it's the same.
That's true. But it would screw some things up because the CFSRQ has some load calculation. It's got some other things in there.
I see.
That wouldn't get added properly.
I see. That makes sense.
So it might look like one CFS is more overloaded than another one.
Okay, I just wanted to check that. That wasn't easy.
And you will have the same problem, just one lever.
No,
because this one will keep its own statistics and its own numbers.
No, it wouldn't be the same because the thing is that everything that is pointed to CFRQ is solved, right?
Yeah.
So if whatever, right, but if this is well defined somehow, I don't know. Probably you don't have to change many things.
Yeah.
Like in this case.
Yeah, the only thing I have to do is mess with the...
but I see what you mean, the counters and all that stuff, okay. Okay. So...
Just that one issue with the group stuff. I wrote a little bit of code today.
Is that working right now? I mean, sort of run, or...?
It'll run, it's just certain threads won't... Like certain threads will sort of like get locked out.
Will start.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. They'll get thrown into like limbo somewhere.
Yeah. I guess the limbo is a non-blocking write.
Yeah. I don't think it's the non-blocking write. The thing is that it'll get thrown onto like some. It'll dereference something which is not a CFSRQ.
Okay.
And it'll manipulate that, and then it'll just get stuck in some memory that it shouldn't be.
I see.
But it should crash the kernel at that point, right?
Not if you don't use that memory. And usually the memory around this is just counters.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll mess up some counters somewhere, and it's just the process will never finish.
Welcome to C.
Yeah.
Anything
it won't crash. It'll just really weird numbers. And
Okay.
I wrote some stuff today. I'll probably be testing it out today and tomorrow.
One thing which I'm concerned is that it seems like your implementation is getting more and more complex. And
it's not actually too complicated. It was just tracking down where a lot of these things were used to make sure that things were set up correctly.
Mm.
Because when, like in the initialization of the kernel, I had to make sure that I initialized the non-blocking write queue for each run queue. Because if not, then it's bad.
I guess it's a data structure problem, right?
Yeah. You just sort of have to find where it's being used and make sure that initializations are called and things like that. And where and when you move things around between the queues, that stuff gets appropriately set.
Hmm. And I know in the kernel you can choose different CPU schedulers, right?
Yes.
Is there, just like the CFS RQ, are there other RQs for the other schedulers?
I think there's only one for the real time. The other ones use the CFS RQ, and then they use different parts of,
okay.
Like the statistics and things.
And they all do things very differently in terms of design, right? So it's not,
yeah.
I mean, it's not that you can look at CFS RQ and the real time RQ to figure out what you need to do for the NBW RQ.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as that.
Right now, it's just implemented using the Ferris scheduler. So
right now, you're just replicating CFS RQ.
Yeah.
So you need to make this NBW guy do everything that CFS is set up to do.
Which isn't too hard. I don't have to rewrite a lot. I just sort of need to make the current code take into account that there's another run queue.
Mm-hmm.
So like when the schedule function gets called, to see that, well, there's nothing on the CFS RQ. Let me check the non-blocking write queue as well.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you change? That's a follow-up question. What happens if you use another scheduler?
Mm-hmm.
Would that be easier to implement in that scheduler?
I am not sure, but I looked at some of the other ones and they all sort of follow the same pattern.
Okay.
I
guess my question is, whatever you're changing is just for CFS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you change it for any of
the other
ones, would that be hard or
more complicated?
More complicated.
Yeah.
Okay.
So to make a generic NBW implementation.
Yeah.
Regardless of the primary scheduler. Okay. Okay, I don't think we need to go there at this point.
Yeah.
No,
I guess it could be sort of made generic, but the
My
thing
point
is that I would have to implement a function for each scheduler for, because CFS, it's easy because the put next task and put previous task are really simple because all they do, it's just a round robin queue. With the other ones, there's more stuff being calculated and done. So with CFS, it's simpler because if I want to put a task on the queue, I just put it at the end, and then I just pick the next one off the front.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't talking about the generic one, but I'm making generic as more about taking an easier route. Right?
Yeah, with the other ones, like for me, it was I looked at the structure that defines all the scheduling functions, the one that sets all the function pointers,
mm-hmm.
and I just read through most of those, and for CFS, it was just it's the default scheduler, and it's also the simplest one.
Okay. Fair enough.
All right. So what about the other tasks? How are things going with the benchmarks? And
So what I did was, I remember that I measure the mode switch time. And also, and also measure the time of every individual phase in the non-blocking write path, right? So some numbers here. Well, the first thing is that the mode switch is much faster than I thought.
Okay.
Actually measure, what I did, the way I measure the mode switch
right.
was to repeat 10 million times
both, the average.
And then average that. And it turns out that it was close to 300 nanoseconds, I think.
Okay.
That includes some overhead, but I'm assuming that...
So it's still much smaller than the duration of an I/O operation.
It's much smaller, yeah.
And that's really the overhead that we incur?
Although, you know, it's 300 nanoseconds, so even three of them add up to one microsecond. So, I mean...
They get to add up relatively.
Yeah.
They're still a lot slower.
So they happen fast, right? Because it's for every memory access. So probably, yeah, they start adding up fast. So that's something we need to be careful. Okay, so I have a bunch of numbers. For those 10 million faults, I found that the disassembly took 18 seconds out of approximately 62 seconds, which was 30% more or less of the time. So it's actually a substantial amount of time, I think. But that happened 10 million times, so I calculated it was It was more or less 10 microseconds. One microsecond per
disassembly.
Per disassembly, exactly. One microsecond.
Did you also do the same thing for single stepping?
I did the same thing for single stepping, but it turns out in this particular case there was not single stepping. I guess I have to disable
if you just
assembly and so on.
See if there's
a difference. Yeah, I didn't do that.
Because I'm wondering, because it's already 300 microseconds?
Nanoseconds for the context switch. 300 nanoseconds. 300 microseconds is not much. It sounds like a lot, but there is also a lot of overhead, because that 300 nanoseconds include a bunch of code before getting to the tool swap page.
Oh, that's true.
And then the code of the user space itself.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And I couldn't...
Because 300 memory closes a lot.
And I guess...
In terms of what memory requires.
Taking the time.
Say that again?
And I guess also the code for taking the timing.
To measure
the
time. To measure the time?
Yeah.
But that shouldn't be much. Because I measure the time just... starting at 10 million and end of the 10 million.
So it looks like the disassembly is nothing compared to... The disassembly time is nothing compared to the time it takes to do the interrupts?
Actually, it's the other way around.
Disassembly is three times the...
Three times, 1 microsecond,
that's a lot, actually, right?
But, so one thing I wanted to say is that right now, in our implementation, we need to do single stepping, disassembly, to calculate some weird cases we cannot handle. Remember the border memory, page border stuff? So for that, we need to do disassembly.
Do we? Because we have the...
We do.
Oh, that's right, because sometimes the address it gives you is not the address it's actually trying to write to.
Exactly.
Because it could have faulted like two bytes before, and then it's like halfway through.
So one workaround, I was thinking about that some time ago, and one workaround is if we have a fault to the address 0 of a page, we just follow the normal path.
Okay. Right. Yeah, we can do that and then just see what numbers we get for the amount
of time. But the way we're doing right now is that we do disassembly even to single stepping.
Yeah. Well, I guess the disassembly takes, 1 microsecond, and then we have 300 nanoseconds per interrupt. But the thing is, to do the single stepping, we already issued the one interrupt to get to the handler. We have to go back to user space, issue another one to come back, and then go back to user space.
So the disassembly is 1 microsecond without single stepping.
Yeah. Without single stepping, yeah.
So the single stepping would require partial disassembly. Mm-hmm. Right, and then 2 context switches.
Yeah, but in our implementation, because we found this weird case inter page.
Yeah. So if you're writing to one page, if you're crossing a page boundary with a write, and the first page you're writing to is in memory, it'll give you the address of the address of the second page. So you can't just use that address plus something to get it.
So it's more complicated disassembly.
Yes.
We just need the actual address that was being written to in the first place.
But what you're saying is that there are instructions that can write 2 pages at the same time.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing not contiguous pages.
They're
virtually contiguous.
Yeah, basically, but not,
not physically
but
not contiguous.
Well, they could be physically contiguous.
Yeah.
It could be, but it's not necessary.
Yeah. Well, if you're faulting...
Just one instruction can write 2 different, not contiguous pages.
Yeah. Really nice.
So you're saying that context switch overhead is 300 nanoseconds. I want us to get a sense for whether that's is sort of a realistic value that other people have also found.
Yeah,
by looking at some recent papers and things like that. I would say look at the...
You mean disassembly or more
the context switch?
More switch.
Yeah, okay.
So look at the FlexSC paper.
Okay. They probably have something like
that. Maybe a couple of other papers, because they might have some of these numbers. And the other thing which I wanted to say is that we need to start adding these numbers to the paper. So maybe you can look at the paper and come up with a suggestion where we could add it.
Yeah, I wonder if the fault is different than the season call.
Right.
In terms of the path?
In terms of time in the CPU. Because they talk about season call.
Yes and no. Because when you do the, because there's an IRQ handler and then there's an ISR handler, and then the one that's getting issued for the page fault is actually, I think you get ISR handlers for both since it's a page fault. Yeah, you get an ISR handler for both. It's just the only place where they diverge is that the error code that gets pushed onto the stack, but the process is different. So it's just a lookup in a table.
Didn't they have this instruction C-center that was optimized to not have to interrupt the CPU or something?
For
syscalls.
Well, syscalls you have to issue an interrupt. It's just that you push it.
But didn't they have this C-center one that replaced the interrupt?
Mm-hmm.
But then they had this DM enter when they went for.
I remember. I think six still uses int. The interrupts with the value hex 25 or
something. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I think we can discuss that later.
Yeah.
I want to go and talk about, because we only have about 5 minutes before 5 o'clock.
Sure. So the other thing is that the minor, I divided the first phase of the non-blocking write in minor and major, which is we have a non-blocking write for a minor fault. Yeah, we have a non-blocking write for a minor fault, which means the page is in memory, or a major fault, which means the page is not in memory. In the case of a minor, we have in total 1.2 seconds for 9.6 million calls. I mean, I guess faults, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I'm saying is that 1.2 seconds is what it takes to look up in the page cache for 9.6 million pages.
So Lewis, can you do the following? Because we don't have time, maybe you can create a table and break up all of these numbers and different things, and then maybe we can come back and discuss it next time.
Okay.
Right. Are you going to be around next week, or are you leaving?
I'm leaving next week, Saturday.
Next week, Saturday.
Yeah,
okay.
But I don't know how busy I will be. I have to do some,
Okay. That's fine. Then maybe we can just communicate over email.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I think what we need to do eventually is to, put this breakdown in the paper itself.
Okay.
And so
okay.
Maybe you can actually do exactly that, which is add the table of this breakdown in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then think about how we, why we are presenting those numbers and how to connect it to the rest of the paper.
Okay.
Okay. In terms of that SVN replay thing, how's that?
Yeah, I didn't work on that.
Okay. So do you think you would have time to finish that up before you go?
Well, the scripts are done. The only thing missing is to look for the SVN servers that we want to replay and replay them.
Okay. So I would say at this point, come up with some example SVN servers, whatever it is available, so that and get the whole system to actually produce the benchmark that
okay.
we can use. Right?
Okay.
If we wanted to change the SVN server at some point, it'll probably be easier. But if we have the whole system working and completed by you, then it'll be easier for someone else to do that.
Okay.
So maybe you can finish up that table, complete this benchmark before you go.
Okay.
Right? Because I know that it's very hard when you move to do all of these things. But so I don't want you to do things that you cannot really handle at all.
Yeah.
Right? So just tell me that.
Okay.
How are things going with you, Daniel?
Well, I read the whole chapter, and it was pretty much clear. I didn't have too much answer and questions, and I worked for a while with reviewing some code, and I also found some build server that it was supposed to use Git, but I haven't tried to put it to work since it was kind of difficult to follow the configuration
okay.
file, but it's supposed to just specify notify the Git server and some Git comments to that server, and it should work. It should just, every time that, that someone do a commit, the Git server somehow notifies the build server that there is a new version, and it will pull it and build it.
So what is required in, so just to refresh everyone's memory, this is a build server benchmark that you're trying to create, right?
Yes.
And so what does this benchmark actually do? What are the operations it does?
Well, it supposedly has different schedules that I didn't really understand. I need to check it again. But it seems like this one seems like use Git, and somehow when someone commits to Git, the Git server can notify that there is a new version.
I see.
That's what I understood. And then the build server can know about that and run some scripts.
So
from which it can be just get a version, the most current version, and build it.
Okay.
And run some tests if you want.
Okay. So this build server is something that you, that already exists, you downloaded it, that someone else who built it.
Yes, that's one that I found and
okay.
kind of set it up.
Okay. So that's something that you want to do next.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, guys. I think we are out of time.
But are we meeting next time? Next week?
We'll meet next week. Maybe we can meet at an earlier time than 5 or 4 p.m. whenever we're meeting right now.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we can schedule it based on your availability. So I think we're probably going to be busy.
Yeah. Okay.
So next Tuesday, and set up a time that works for
everyone. Actually, Tuesday's not a good day.
Okay, then Wednesday or Thursday, whatever day.
Yeah, I think Wednesday is probably a better day.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. See you guys. Thanks.
Very. We'll be here.